Television viewers by the millions have followed the Real Housewives of Orange County and the Real Housewives of Atlanta, New Jersey, New York City. Now one of cable's most successful reality shows is moving to the nation's capital. It premieres on the Bravo channel this Thursday. NPR's Netta Ulaby wondered how her adopted hometown is presented in the Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
It's actually one location, two places, Washington and D.C. Washington is the federal government, monuments, museums. It's the power elite of the city and the Maryland and Virginia suburbs.
God bless D.C. and its vanilla suburbs.
D.C. to Parliament Funkadelic is Chocolate City. It's taxation without representation. It's so-called mayor for life, Marion Barry. Even the Washingtonian magazine draws a distinction between Washington and D.C., says editor Alyssa Rosenberg.
If we're talking about Washington, it's the area as a whole. If we're talking about the district, it's D.C. proper.
Here's the one you'll see in The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
This city is filled with galas and events. It's important to know which ones to attend.
This town is small. Everybody has an agenda.
I asked anthropology professor Sabia Prince to look at the new season's first episode. She studies the cultural history of Washington and D.C.
These women are inhabiting, perhaps, to use that dichotomy, the world of Washington, more so than they are D.C.
Indeed. It's hard to imagine a sport less of D.C. than polo. But the first episode of The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C. features a polo match incongruously plopped right on the National Mall, one of the country's great public spaces. It was organized by America's most famous gatecrashers, Tariq and Michaela Salahi.
Salahi shoots!
One of the so-called housewives sees this match as worse than ridiculous. Her D.C.-based business had a bad experience with the event in the past.
It's not good for my business, and it's definitely not good for the city. I just have no desire to ever go back or be associated with that little goat rodeo.
The first season of any Real Housewives is about building relationships between women who are not necessarily friends in real life. Washington, D.C.'s black majority in this version is represented by one African-American, a district resident, and four white women who live in Maryland or Northern Virginia.
Girlfriend,
some unfortunate girlfriending and snapping of fingers from a housewife at a party who also brags about living near Dick Cheney in McLean, Virginia. She gets tipsy and corners two black guests to lecture them about a pressing social problem.
Salons need to integrate. We have different hair, different needs, but why do we have to be in a different salon?
The Real Housewives franchise purports to give its viewers a look at a place through one of its largely closed worlds, athletes' wives in Atlanta or a volatile New Jersey family. A story about white Washington suburbs versus a black urban D.C. is completely out of date, says anthropology professor Sabia Prince.
Washington is getting more diverse now. For so long, D.C. was about the dichotomy between black and white, and that's not even accurate anymore.
Prince describes Washington, D.C.'s culture as layered and complicated. She says maybe it's even big enough for party-crashing Virginians playing polo by the Washington Monument.
One group does not have a monopoly over this place that we call Washington, D.C. So I'm okay with highlighting bits and pieces of what else is going on. It's a part of the cultural dynamism of the place.
But the cultural dynamics of Washington, D.C., or the dynamics of the cast, was apparently not enough for series producers. They failed to get enough material for 13 episodes. The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C. has only 9, which, even for a cable show, is pretty short. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Well, summer is the season of ice-cold lemonades, vacations at the beach, fireflies and fireworks, and family reunions. Families throughout the United States gather to connect across generations, tell and retell stories, and simply enjoy themselves and eat a lot of food. This weekend, a very special family reunion is taking place. The Quander family, one of the oldest and largest documented black families in America, will hold its 85th family reunion. For the first time, this will happen at at Mount Vernon, one of the places where Quandre family members were held as slaves. In just a moment, we will talk with one of the organizers of the reunion. But first, we want to invite you into the conversation as well. Does your family hold annual reunions? What do they mean to you? Call us and tell us your story. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address, talk@npr.org. And to join the conversation, go to our website, npr.org, and click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now is Rahulamin Quandre. He is president of the Quandre Historical Society and an administrative judge for Washington, D.C. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, welcome, Tony. It's good to be here with you this afternoon.
Before I ask you to give us a bit of your family history, I'm curious about this. Why are these reunions important?
I think reunions are very important because we lead such busy lives. We're so diversified all over the country and in different industries. It's time to pause and reflect as to who we are as a family and to share with the older people, the younger people, all of us coming together just in a relaxed atmosphere to share what's important about family.
We're going to invite some of the Quandres. If you're out there, Quandres, listening to us, give us a call, 800-989-8255, and join the conversation. So, Rahulamin, tell me about your family. When did the first Quandres arrive in this country?
Well, the records show that there were Quandres present in Charles County, Maryland in the late 1600s. The oral history says that the family was brought in, presumably from Ghana. Two brothers got separated in southern Maryland and were not able to reconnect, but their descendants did. Subsequently, ancestors showed up on the Virginia side of the river, and some of them were in service to George Washington. So we've been invited to come, all Quandres, regardless of whether the Mount Vernon Grape Group or not, have been invited by the Mount Vernon Ladies Association to celebrate a very special occasion, the 85th annual Quandre Family Reunion.
One of the things that I understand is unique about the Quandres is the Quandre name itself. You're not Jeffersons, you're not Washingtons, you're Quandres, and there is a reason for that, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, the family record of being in bondage and also in freedom goes back to the 1600s, when the rules on slave names and surnames was not yet cast in as it became. So we were able to hold on to our original African name, which we believe was Umquando. It's a Fanti name. When the forebear was asked his name and said Umquando, to untrained ears they heard Quando. And the records appear as name appears as Quando in the earlier records and got corrupted to Quandre with the passage of time.
So Quandres are everywhere in the United States, am I to believe?
Well, I don't know about being everywhere. We're concentrated in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia, but we have spread around to other parts of the country. But we are definitely concentrated in this area and in Pennsylvania.
Now, when you have your reunion, it begins tomorrow or Saturday?
Begins on Friday with a big fish fry on Quandre Road, and then Saturday at Mount Vernon and a Sunday at church.
So you have your own street?
We do have a Quandre Road in Virginia, and there will be a new Quandre Street coming back in D.C. It was here before, right across the street from the baseball stadium, and it's coming back as the area is reconstructed. It's already on the map, but not on the, there are no street signs yet.
So how many Quandres and extended Quandres do you expect to show up?
Well, it's hard to say. I know the count is well over 100, might be 150. But anybody who has a history of the name Quandre, even if that's not their current surname, is still a Quandre. But people come, older people come, they go and drift away. Newer people come in who've never been a part of it. But we're going to have a good crowd, and it's going to be a good core as we look forward to our centennial, which will be in another 15 years. But it has to start now.
Now, I know that family reunions are about getting together, as you said, when we first started talking, and also, you know, having a good time and connecting and looking back. How much of this is about the history of your particular family and an attempt to keep it going by educating the youngsters about who you really are?
Well, a lot of it is about history, but I think the emphasis now is to realize that it's more important to talk about the now and the family, to keep a good core of the history so that we know the history and we celebrate the history. But it's most important for those of us in the here and the now, the younger people, the older people, those in the middle, to keep the association going.
Is there such a thing as a Quandre family cemetery?
Well, I wouldn't say there's a Quandre family cemetery, but there's several places where many of us are buried. For example, the Bethel Cemetery in Alexandria, and actually inside the slave memorial at Mount Vernon, oral history. There are no records showing who's buried there, but oral history has several of the Quandre ancestors buried right there next to George Washington.
So being in Mount Vernon, that's really significant for your family, isn't it, this weekend?
It's very significant. Only the second African-American family to have a family reunion there. Family descended from several names like Wes Ford, who is himself reputed to be a Washington descendant, and Quandas descended from Wes Ford. So there is apparently a possible sanguine connection, and that's why it's so important that the Ladies Association invited us to come and celebrate.
Let's take a call. You feel like that?
Sure enough.
All right, this is Diane joining us from Winterville, North Carolina. Diane, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Well, you're welcome.
You have a comment or a question?
Well, my story is, the family story has always been, my great-great-grandfather served in the Civil War for the North, and that he shook hands with Abraham Lincoln while he was in a hospital in New Hampshire during the Civil War, actually. So that's our story, and I do have it verified by an obituary. He died in 1936. He was in his 90s. And his name was Louis de la Marche Brico.
Well, do you have family reunions?
Yes, we do. We have family reunions, and this would come up at family reunions, and people would talk about him, and that's like folklore in our family. That's our story.
All right, well, thank you very much for sharing it with us. It raises something else I'd like to ask you about, which is this. It's hard enough sometimes to organize a high school reunion, thinking of trying to get in touch with all the people in the family and get them to one place at one time. That's a difficult task, isn't it?
It's a very difficult task, and we have an excellent president, Robin Quander Whitmire, very dedicated, and I've been blessed to ask to speak on Saturday, and one of the things I'm going to focus on is that at the 85th, we are in sight of the centennial, but in order to make it a good centennial and well beyond, we have to remember that all of us have to step up and play an important part in the family history, in planning, whether it be food or activity or history. Everyone has to do something in order to make it a success.
Rahul, I mean, what you're saying sounds to me a little bit like, correct me if I'm wrong here, that even in a big family like yours that has roots way, way back here in the United States, that when it comes down to doing the work, it falls on a few shoulders.
It always falls on a few shoulders, roll up the sleeves, and it seems to be the same few shoulders. But if you've got good leadership and you have some interest and focus, it makes the job infinitely easier. And, of course, it makes you feel very appreciated.
Now, some of the Quanders who have gone on to do a number of very important things and have been accomplished in their lives, let's talk about a couple of them. One, I understand, is a member of the sorority Alpha Kappa Alpha, not just a member, but one of the founders, Nellie Quander, is that right?
She was the lead national corporator and served as a supreme bossess, which is like president, for almost 9 years, yes, from 1910 to 1919.
Are there others that are standouts in the family you want to share your story with?
Yes. I certainly think we should know about the generals Vincent and Leo Brooks. They're three generals, a father and two sons, who are outstanding members of the family. They are Quanda descendants. And we have locally the retired Deputy Fire Chief Joseph Quander. We have the former director of CSOSA, Paul Quander. We have a number of people here in the metropolitan Washington area who have continued to do other things. I published two books myself and got two more in the hopper. But members of the family who have continued to work in the community. But we don't put the emphasis on who is well-known. We put the emphasis on the individual, a lot of teachers, a lot of people who are working with children. And that is really the interaction about the history and strength of our family.
And you do try to have some fun, right?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. You know, we're getting some emails and some phone calls in. This is an email from Gretchen talking about other people and their reunions and what they do. I just returned from 1 week in the woods with no running water, no electricity, pit toilets, and lots of mosquitoes. The farthest travelers came from Hawaii to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, the youngest member just 2 months old. One of the most fun traditions is the formal dinner where the men cook spaghetti and the dress is from the thrift shops. We look forward to the next reunion in 5 years with hopefully every one of these members and more. We've lost a whole generation, the people pictured on our shirts since the last gathering. Before I take this call, do you guys wear shirts with your names and stuff on it?
We will have our beautiful t-shirts. It'll be issued to us tomorrow, and when we show up at Mount Vernon, 10 o'clock Saturday morning, They've asked us to come all adorned in our T-shirts.
Is that a black thing?
Well, it is a black thing because I have not ever seen a predominantly white family that's had a family reunion in which they came up with T-shirts.
I'm
not saying
either.
That they haven't. But I think the reason for that is that the black family reunion is part of an extension where the families were violently separated, and once they were able to come back together during Reconstruction, and many of them never did find their ancestors. So the family reunion concept is something that's started out primarily as an African-American thing, although it has spread into the other communities.
Well, talking about that, let's go to, I think it's Ina joining us from Tennessee. Ina, you're on Talk of the Nation. How are you?
Doing very well. How are you?
I'm fine. Did I say it right? Is it Ina?
You did say it right. It is. It's a strange name.
All right. Well, tell us about your family reunion story.
Well, I do want to say right quick, we have T-shirts, and we're white.
Oh, okay.
We got T-shirts that we get every year. Anyway, my family, the Dam family, D-A-M, we have, that's my mom's dad, Norman Dam. And we all get together at my parents' house, and we have a three-day event called Marshall Rue. And this year, we did something really fun. We had Dam Olympics, and we played this game called the Greased Watermelon. And what we did was we had two teams in the pool, and we greased up this watermelon Crisco, and we were in the pool. And it was kind of like football. Your objective is you're trying to get it, pass it to the people on the other side. You had two teammates standing on one side of the pool outside, and you're trying to get the watermelon to your teammates on the opposite side. And it's really difficult because you've got this greased watermelon in a pool.
But it
was so much fun and different. And the people at the reunion, my family, I see like maybe once or twice a year. And it is fun and neat because we all get together and it's like there has been no time elapsed.
That's wonderful. That's a great story, Ina. Thank you for sharing it with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So you guys do funny things, you said, at your reunions. Is there anything that is particularly, well, let's say, peculiar to the Quander family reunion?
I wouldn't say so. I said some years we have talent, some years we don't. We try to put ourselves now at a hotel where there's a swimming pool. Historically, because this is our 85th, we've come through in the South here with racial segregation. There were no hotels. We stayed in family homes, and we sat around family porches and had great celebrations. That's how it started, right there down in Woodlawn, in the shadow of the Woodlawn Plantation, which was part of the Washington family estate. But now we've moved to hotels, and we've gone uptown, so to speak.
So that means there won't be any watermelons in the swimming pool.
Well, there'll be a swimming pool, but I don't know if we can go into a hotel and put watermelon in their swimming pool.
Absolutely.
But family gets together, and we go, and we have the big fish fry tomorrow, and family members are catching the fish. So it's not as though we went to the supermarket. There are fishermen in the family who are bringing the fish up from Virginia, from southern part of Virginia, and they are cleaning it, and we will eat the fish that they caught. That's very important.
I got you. Let's take another call if we can. This is David joining us from, it looks like, Eau Claire, Wisconsin. David, how are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
No problem. Tell us your story.
Well, this June I just returned with my family from our 79th annual family reunion. And that was held where it's held every year in a small town south of Chicago called Kankakee, Illinois. And about 80 years ago, my grandfather and his siblings emigrated from Sicily into the Chicago area. And the family reunion was 80 years ago or 79 years ago. It was a way to get together and celebrate with each other, enjoy a little fellowship, and remain dedicated to the family.
Is there something that your family does that is unique to you at your reunion?
Is there something that we do that's unique to me?
To your family, yes, that your family does at their reunion that's sort of unique.
You know what we do? And, well, first of all, I should tell you that my children, who are 13, 14, and 16, it's the thing that they look forward most to every year, going to the family reunion. But this, one of the things that we do, I think, that's pretty unique is we have photos going back 100 years from my great-grandparents, and we have these photos that we bring every year, and we put them up in the dining hall at the park where we have the reunion. And it's really touching, you know, because we get 125 people, and before we eat, we say a little prayer, and then couple moments of silence and you think about the people who came before you and made this life possible for you. And now we have graduates from, you know, Northwestern and Notre Dame and
that's great,
University
David.
Of Wisconsin and Illinois.
I've got to stop you because time is running out. That's a great story. Congratulations on your family reunion. I hope that you guys have many, many more to come. I want to thank you for your time as well because this has been an interesting conversation. Rahul Amin Quander of the Quander Family Reunion, which is going to be a big deal this weekend at Mount Vernon. He is an administrative judge for Washington, D.C. and president of the Quander Historical Society. Tomorrow it is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. Ira Flato will be here getting geeky in the kitchen. He'll have some techie cooking tips from a former software engineer. Have fun at the reunion. I'd like to go join you, but I can't.
We're looking forward to it. Thank you very much. Come on down.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Tony Cox.
This summer, we're taking a look at some unusual museums across the country. It's time for another stop along our Holiday Road.
Holiday Road. Holiday Road.
Today, we hit the outskirts of Boston, Massachusetts, where you can find a shrine to atrocious acrylics and inferior oils. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I'm Michael Frank, and I'm the curator-in-chief of the Museum of Bad Art.
That's right, it's the Museum of Bad Art, or MOBA, as it's affectionately known by bad art aficionados. It bills itself as the world's only museum dedicated to the exhibition and celebration of bad art. Michael Frank says that last bit is important. Celebration. The museum is all in good fun.
What we look for are pieces of work that were produced in an attempt to make some sort of artistic statement, but clearly something has gone wrong.
Let's try to picture what we're talking about here. We asked Louise Riley Sacco, who helped found MOBA, to describe a piece called Dog.
It's a puppy who's staring straight ahead with bright yellow eyes, but then at the top it seems to turn into a mountain covered with snow that melds into the puppy's head.
Yeah, but at least the puppy is not playing poker. The artists themselves have donated many of the pieces to MOBA, and the museum staff comb through thrift stores and garage sales to find even more. Once they're part of the collection, each piece of bad art gets one of those little museum blurbs written by curator Michael Frank.
We offer basic information about the piece itself, a little bit about the provenance, and we offer a brief interpretation.
Like his interpretation of Ronan the Pug, a rough acrylic painting of a dog, eyes glazed, mouth agape, looking more than a little tipsy.
Ronan the Pug could hardly see straight after lapping up all the spilled eggnog at the holiday party, but brought tears to everyone's eyes with his clear tenor rendition of Danny Boy.
Danny Boy. Oh, my. You can see both Dog and Ronan the Pug and learn more about the Museum of Bad Art at NPR.org. And if you have a suggestion for other strangely specific museums, make sure you leave a note on our comments page.
It's Friday and it's August, and that means another batch of new movies are heading to the theaters begging for your hard-earned dollars. But believe it or not, Hollywood is thinking less and less about your dollars and more about someone else's euros and yuan. These days, half or more of a movie's profits come from overseas. In fact, a bomb here in the United States can be a blockbuster abroad. Case in point, this summer's film, The Prince of Persia. Budget? $200 million, and here in the U.S. it only made about $90 million. A flop, right? Wrong. Overseas, it racked up an additional $237 million, and that got us wondering what, and more specifically, what actors have bankable global appeal? And to answer that question, we called on James Ulmer. He created something called the Ulmer Scale. It ranks over 1,000 actors worldwide, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
First off, how does the Ulmer Scale work? What exactly are you measuring, and how do you determine this ranking?
Well, if you think of the Ulmer scale as a kind of a stock market index for the stars, we look at how a star's power, in other words, how able is their name alone to sell a movie and get those bums into the seat, both nationally and worldwide. That's what we measure, and we use really the people who are at the power brokers, the people who are at the intersection of the deal point, the buyers, the sellers worldwide. These are the people that know Bruce Willis's value in Japan versus, you know, Germany or versus America, and who really, really control how well a movie does overseas.
Now, I've got the list right here in front of me, the Ulmer Scales Actors Hot List for 2009-2010. At the top of the list, Will Smith. Why does he top the list?
Will is somebody who is almost indestructible in terms of his ability to choose excellent roles for himself. He's put himself in franchise movies, movies that are, you'd have legs, we call it. Maybe they're in one or two or three versions of them, and they're often action adventures, which always do well overseas. He's also somebody who is really smart and savvy and really orchestrates his career very carefully. He studies a box office, and he just doesn't blindly obey the advice of his manager and agents. He'll really take an active role in his own career choices.
As I look at the list, I'm just going to tick through the top 10 names. Will Smith, Johnny Depp, Brad Pitt, Tom Hanks, George Clooney, Will Ferrell, Nicolas Cage, Reese Witherspoon, Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Cruise. Not a lot of women in that list.
No. Unfortunately, I like to say that the global international marketplace is pretty sexist when it comes to their movie stars because, first of all, they can't lead the marquee. Oftentimes, even today, if you have a Julia Roberts who used to be able to sell a movie based on her name alone, today you'll need a male star. So they're also bankable, as we call it, really mostly in ensembles. They'll also be a little more sensitive to the market fluctuations out there. It's just a sad fact of the international entertainment marketplace.
What are the biggest markets overseas, and what kinds of movies sell well there?
Well, let's just take one of the biggest markets. Traditionally, it's been Japan, and you almost have to ask what kind of movies don't sell too well, because generally, Japan, although you can't make absolute rules, they don't want to touch romantic comedies and some dramas, but they certainly do love the Twilight series. Scandinavia will censor a lot of violence, so Quentin Tarantino films don't do well there. Latin America loves genre movies, horror movies. And I think what you're seeing is that the foreign market, Michelle, is really going, responding to the idea of genre movies. And it's becoming a lot more tuned in to what's successful here in America.
James Ulmer, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
James Ulmer is the creator of the Ulmer Scale. It ranks actors worldwide based on their bankability. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.